Chapter 4. Cities That Silk Built. The Silk Roads. The Library in the Cave. And yet, while China holds our friendship, and heaven remains our neighborhood, why should you linger at the fork of the road, wiping your eyes like a heartbroken child? Wang Bo, AD 650 to 676. Farewell to Vice Prefect Du, setting out for his official post in Shu. Sir Oral Stein remained an enigma to his friends, although they always appreciated the exotic gifts he sent home. Born to Jewish parents in Budapest on the 26th of November 1862, by the time he was 21, he spoke German, Hungarian, Greek, Latin, French, English, Sanskrit, and Persian. Although only 5'4", he had the kind of wiry physique and tenacity that lasts long after those with the ruder sort of power have gone to seed. While on a walking tour of the hill country in northwest India in his 60s, his young local guide made the serious mistake of underestimating his charge's vigor. "Stein Sahib is some kind of supernatural being," he complained to his commanding officer. "He walked me off my legs in the mountains. I could not keep up with him. Please do not send me to him again, sir." It's also possible the guide had his eye on a larger tip. Many decades previously, however, Stein's talents and energy had been concentrated elsewhere, unearthing treasures that had been covered by time and the wind-travelled sands of the Gobi Desert for centuries. The region, not much of a tourist hotspot now, was even more forbidding in the opening decades of the 20th century. Stein, who returned there again and again, travelled frugally. At night, when temperatures dropped precipitously, he would sleep under a thick pile of pelts, pulling his fur coat over his head and breathing through the sleeve to protect his face from frostbite. During the day, his pony's feet would sink in the sand. It is a region best traversed by camel, as would those of his dog, Dash, dressed in a custom Kashmiri fur coat to save him from freezing, but who eventually submitted to being borne along in a camel basket with a hole in the lid. On the 18th of December 1900, Stein came upon the remains of Dan Dan Wilik, abandoned in the late 8th century and marked only by the sun-bleached tops of a few dead fruit trees in what was once an orchard. 7 years later, he saw some even more remarkable traces of the trade route that had once stitched the desert together. This time, however, the triumph of actual discovery belonged to someone else. While Stein scoured desert regions for archaeological treasure, Wang Yuanlu, a Taoist monk, was the lone guardian of a series of remarkable shrines. Known as the Mogao Caves, or the Temples of the Thousand Buddhas, they were situated near Dunhuang, an oasis in northwest China, on the rim of the Gobi Desert. The first ones were carved out in the 4th century. By the 7th century, there were over 1,000, lavishly decorated and, at their peak, attracting thousands of wealthy and influential worshippers. In the centuries since, as the Silk Roads had fallen into disuse, the shrines had largely been forgotten, and Wang Yuanlu's vigil was a lonely one. One day, in the very same year that Stein was making his way from Kashgar and Yarkand on the journey that would lead him to Dan Dan Wilik, Wang was sitting smoking in one of the larger caves when he noticed something rather odd. The smoke from his cigarette was not curling straight upwards or being sucked towards the entrance, as you might expect, but was instead determinedly drifting towards a back wall and disappearing, phantom-like, into the mural that covered it. Perplexed, Wang examined the area closely and realized that what he had always taken to be solid stone was in fact a cunningly rendered wall. He carefully pierced a hole and squeezed through. Behind the 11th century wall lay a room filled with long-forgotten and dust-furred manuscripts and scrolls, piled up so high that the tops of the stacks were lost in the gloom. When he told the local officials, hoping to secure a grant to help conserve these newly discovered treasures, they were dismissive. Seal the room back up again. Despite their seeming indifference, the officials must have been curious enough to gossip. The fact of the hidden cave's existence began to seep out, like water from an ill-glazed clay pot. When Orlstein organized an excursion to the region in 1907, it was to Dunhuang that he bent his footsteps. "I confess," he later wrote, "what kept my heart buoyant were secret hopes of another and more substantial kind." 2 months before, vague rumours about a great hidden deposit of ancient manuscripts had reached him, and he was impatient to test their veracity. He was not disappointed. Having overcome Wang's objections, he was shown through the aperture the Taoist priest had made. Heaped up in layers, but without any order, there appeared in the dim light of the priest's little oil lamp a solid mass of manuscript bundles rising to 10 feet from the floor and filling, as subsequent measurement showed, close on 500 cubic feet. The contents of that room were one of the greatest archaeological discoveries of the century. The library, as it was reverently known thereafter, contained documents in 17 languages and 24 scripts, many of which have long since expired. The collection includes the Diamond Sutra, a copy of one of Buddha's sermons, and the oldest known printed book. There were also countless works of art and silken textiles. Opening one packet, Stein found it full of fine paintings on silk and cotton, ex votos in all kinds of silk and brocade. He bought around 10,000 documents and artworks for the British Museum for the beggarly sum of £130. Scholars the world over, particularly since the scattered collection was digitized and virtually reunited in 2013, have through this one remarkable find gained a window into the lives lived and goods traded along the Silk Roads many centuries before. Trade and tribulations. These men all uphold the law of Muhammad. In the city are industrious merchants. They make robes of silk and gold of various fashions, and raise also plenty of cotton. Marco Polo on the People of Persia. The Travels of Marco Polo, circa 1298. One of Stein's most evocative discoveries was a wooden panel intended as an offering to Buddha. On it were painted scenes of the popular legend of how the long-guarded secrets of silk-making escaped from China, breaking their 5,000-year virtual monopoly. The tale, although it has many different versions, has at its heart a princess from Lulan. At the moment she turned from a girl to a young woman, she was promised by her parents to the ruler of the nearby kingdom of Khotan. Because the practice of sericulture was well known in the princess's home, she had spent her entire life swaddled in silken robes. There was no silk to be had, however, in the lands of her betrothed. Despairing of a silkless future, the princess defiantly snatched up some of the soft white cocoons from their special trays in the palace and tucked them into the piles of her elaborately dressed hair so that she could smuggle them to her new home. This tale reinforces a certain long-held view about the Silk Roads, that goods flowed, sometimes illicitly, generally westwards out of what is now China. It wasn't unified until the 3rd century BC. The truth is rather more complicated. The term the Silk Roads was coined in German by a 19th century geographer called Baron Ferdinand von Richthofen. The plural form is important. The roads were a constantly shifting network of well-trodden land routes that spread, like questing plant routes, throughout Central Asia. The principal east-to-west artery ran from Chang'an along the Kanzhou Corridor, across the Tarim Basin and the Pamirs, through Turkestan, usually via Samarkand, and then through modern-day Iran, Iraq, Syria, and finally to the shores of the Mediterranean. However, it would be wrong to think that most goods started at one end and determinedly made their way to the other. While China began to open up more fully to trade with the Central and Western Asian states in the 2nd century BC under Emperor Wu, trade networks between these states existed beforehand. There was also a long and flourishing tradition of Sino-Indian trade. Evidence appears in the Arthashastra, the devious Indian treatise on statecraft written as early as the 4th century BC, before the unification of China. Then, as later, silk was only a tiny fraction of the goods that were being traded, but it was certainly an important one. The text contains the word Sinapata, meaning a bunch of Chinese silk. Many of the exchanges that took place along the Silk Roads would have been local, and most of those living along these routes would have been nomadic or involved in agriculture, for the most part independent of the business of trade, only occasionally exchanging furs, fruits or horses for tools or other objects or substances made or collected elsewhere. But the roads were used by more enterprising traders also. Merchants' caravans crisscrossed the region along a multitude of paths, bearing all manner of goods back and forth. And even if they did not know it, they were also spreading ideas, artistic styles, religions, and even diseases. Letters and news also travelled along these channels, the first event of world history recorded in both Western and Chinese sources was the fall of the Greco-Bactrian Empire in 130 BC. The Silk Roads were not constant over time. They waxed and waned, broke up and reformed in response to demand and unrest across the region. Roughly speaking, after pushing east into China in around the 2nd century BC, they were at their most influential from around 100 BC until around AD 1, the 2nd and 3rd centuries, in the eras of the Tang and early Islam, the 7th and 8th centuries, and during the 13th and 14th centuries, when the Mongol Empire ruled swathes of Eurasia, allowing trade to flourish. Travelling the Silk Roads was no easy matter, even during the 20th century. The rough terrain the roads crossed included the Gobi Desert, infamous for its extreme temperature fluctuations, as well as storms that unleashed clouds of choking sand. The Bactrian camel was perfectly suited to these harsh conditions and was therefore highly valued by traders. Far hardier and better adapted to the desert landscape than other pack animals, they could also sense approaching sandstorms, which, if they caught travellers unawares, could be deadly. Before any human could discern anything amiss, the Bactrian camels would immediately stand snarling together, according to one writer. The travellers, taking the hint, would cover their noses and mouths by wrapping them in felt. But even caravans of experienced traders could suffer mishaps. Court documents dating from AD 670 reveal the case of an Iranian living in China who was asking for the court's assistance in recovering 273 bolts of silk owed to his brother. The brother had, after lending the silk to his Chinese partner, set off into the desert on a business trip with 2 camels, 4 head of cattle, and a donkey. The party was never heard from again. So many goods and people attracted robbers too. One report from a Silk Road city specifies that 7 strings of pearls, 1 mirror, a lastuga, a kind of gown, made of many coloured silk, and a Sudi ear ornament were filched. The thief was later caught and confessed, but had apparently had time both to sell his loot and to spend the money, as he was unable to pay back his victim. Such dangers were usually amply rewarded for those willing to run the risks. Armenians, who were successful long-distance travellers, would buy an 18-pound bale of silk for 20 crowns and sell them at 30. A single horse could carry around 30 bales, while a hardy camel might manage 55, meaning a handsome profit for every load. Sogdians, hailing from a Central Asian civilization near today's Samarkand, were also expert long-distance traders. In a ruined watchtower near the Thousand Buddha Shrines, Orlstein found a packet of letters likely penned in the early 4th century by Sogdians living in China. A couple are full of panicked descriptions of famine and unrest, and the destruction by the Huns of important Silk Road cities. But the letters also reveal the network of trades being done across the region by the Sogdian diaspora, and the systems of credit they had set up and could call upon to conduct business. The Vikings and the Viking Rus, an early medieval people who lent their name to their homelands of Russia and Belarus, were also indefatigable long-range traders of wax, amber, honey, and especially silk gleaned from cities threaded along the Silk Roads. Rather than using the land routes, they used rivers, the Oder, Neva, Volga, and Dnieper, sailing in longboats adapted so that they could be carried between rivers and lakes if necessary. Although more recent research has done much to transmute the Vikings' warlike reputation into something rather more mercantile, descriptions of the Rus from their own day suggest the former reputation was well-deserved. A generous Muslim contemporary noted their great stamina and endurance. Others accused them of taking part in orgies and treachery to their fellows, robbing or murdering them if they were given half a chance. "They never go off alone to relieve themselves," wrote another observer, "but always go with three companions to guard them, sword in hand, for they have little trust in each other." They were particularly mistrusted by the Byzantines. After a surprise raid on Constantinople in AD 860, their access to the city was limited. No more than 50 Rus were allowed into the city at any one time, and they had to enter by a particular gate, register their names, and submit to being closely monitored until their departure. The Silk Roads and the caravans, traders, goods, and money that flowed through them had tangible effects on the countries they traversed. Wealth collected in pools around popular trading posts and oases. Palmyra, on the edge of the Syrian desert, was one such place. Greek, Persian, Roman, and Islamic cultures had all left a visible patina on the city's monuments, and it was, at one time, known as the Venice of the Sands. Many of the ancient sites that embody the city's rich and multicultural heritage, including large sections of a Roman theatre and an Arch of Triumph that had stood for 1,800 years, have been destroyed by ISIS since they captured the city in 2015. Such cities made deep impressions on those who saw them. In the tales of his wanderings along the Silk Roads in the 13th century, Marco Polo lavishes praise on them. The Middle Eastern port of Kormos, we learn, is full of ships from India, bearing all kinds of spiceries, precious stones and pearls, cloths of silk and gold, elephant's teeth, and many other articles. Further east, the cities of Ta'infu and Pianfu are not only the only part of Cathay where wine is made, but also yield much silk, abounding in the trees on which the worms are fed. Because the Silk Roads, when they were busy, made the countries through which they cut more porous by their very existence, beliefs as diverse as Islam, Zoroastrianism, and Christianity brushed shoulders with one another and even coexisted in one place. In Palmyra, these influences were emphatically rendered in stone, but they left their mark elsewhere too. Mesopotamian Jews were involved in the Silk Road trade. The Midrash, the commentary that runs alongside Hebrew scriptures, contains a parable of sorts that involves the setting aside of some valuable silk by one man after another has promised to buy it. Although the buyer doesn't come for his purchase for a long time, the seller keeps faith. "Thy word," he says when his customer does eventually arrive, "is stronger in my eyes than money." Buddhism flourished in China in part because of the exchange of ideas facilitated by the trade routes, eventually becoming one of the country's three major religions. Silk embedded itself deeply within the faith's religious practices. Silks were used to wrap important relics and scriptures, a practice later borrowed by other beliefs, including Christianity. Benedict Biscop, the English abbot of Wearmouth and Jarrow, made 5 trips to Rome in the mid-7th century, and he returned to his Northumbrian monasteries bearing books, relics, and rich silks with which to wrap them. At least one Buddhist monastery fined monks a set number of bolts of silk when they transgressed. Buddhist relics flowed into the country from India, Buddha's birthplace, and the cradle of the religion. The 1,000 Buddha shrines in which the library cave was found were just one instance of this religious flowering. The city of Dandanwilik was imprinted with Buddhism too. Over 2 weeks from Stein's discovery of the city on 11th of December 1900, he exposed and excavated over a dozen structures, both temples and dwellings. Much of the art he found was inflected with Indian characteristics. The Buddhist texts he unearthed were written in Sanskrit. Buddhist monks and pilgrims were just as likely to use the Silk Roads as traders. They were less likely to be robbed or attacked, and, since it was believed hosting them was a form of devotion in and of itself, they could be a useful addition to more commercial caravans as well. Such was the experience of 7 Khotanese princes whose travels were outlined in some of the library cave documents. They travelled with 3 monks, and when the group was mistreated by the local ruler of Dunhuang, an emissary claimed to have reproached the ruler, who then apologised. "How I did harm upon the monks," he was reported as saying, "and brought about a bad name for myself." One of the most famous religious travellers of the age was the Chinese pilgrim Xuanzang, who journeyed through the region during the early 7th century. It was the name of this man, a hero to many Taoists, that Orlstein invoked to persuade Wang Yuanlu, the guardian of the 1,000 Buddha's shrines, to let him see the library cave, and later, to buy and carry off some of its contents. The business of silk. Beyond this region, by now at the northernmost point, where the sea ends somewhere on the outer fringe, there is a very great island city called Thina, China, from which silk floss, yarn, and cloth are shipped by land via Bactria to Barigaza and via the Ganges River back to Limeriki. Periplus Maris Erythrae, circa AD 40 to 70. Although it was far from the only thing merchants traded, silk was among the most consistent, valuable, and easily portable products humped across deserts and mountains in the swaying caravans. Most came from China, which was the natural habitat of both the Bombyx mori moth and its food, white mulberry, and was naturally enough where sericulture had first emerged. The Chinese had thousands of years to perfect the craft, grow the lush mulberry orchards needed to feed the silkworms, and develop many of the specialized looms needed to make particularly complex and luxurious fabrics. Silk wasn't officially exported outside China before the first Han dynasty, around 140 to 134 BC. Before then, if anyone was caught smuggling silkworms, either as eggs or cocoons, or even mulberry seeds or saplings, they could be executed. When it did reach other regions, it was highly prized. Silks from China were known in Egypt in the 1st century BC. The Sidonian robes that Lucan describes Cleopatra as wearing, and which he lasciviously noted revealed her breasts, certainly sound like the sheerest of silks. These robes, made by the skill of the Ceres, the needle of the workmen of the Nile has separated and has loosened the warp by stretching the weft. Such reworking of imported silks was not uncommon. In Western Asia, there was a tradition of buying plain Chinese silk to embroider, or to unravel and reweave into special damasks and gold-embellished fabrics. Soon enough, however, the knowledge and practice of sericulture took root there also. Justinian I, who ruled the Byzantine Empire from AD 527 until 565, is said to have encouraged two monks to smuggle cocoons out of the east on their travels. Knowing the punishments, the pair cleverly hid their illicit cargo in hollowed-out walking canes. Whether or not this picturesque tale has any truth to it, we do know that once silk production took hold in Persia, they proved themselves to be adept. It helped that Persia was the home of a black variant of mulberry tree that the silkworms were able to eat, although this diet apparently made the resultant thread slightly less fine. Nevertheless, the production of silk in the region subsequently reached annual levels of 10,000 zooms, a measurement equal to 2 bales, each of which weighed up to 2 pounds. The Persians specialized in rich fabrics inlaid with precious metals or intricately decorated with figures, beasts, and plants. Silk made an excellent gift. After winning a compelling military victory in AD 997, Mansur, a Muslim ruler, rewarded his supporters, Christian and Muslim alike, with 2,285 pieces of Tiraz silk, 2 robes perfumed with ambergris, 11 pieces of scarlet cloth, 7 brocade carpets, and various other textiles. 2 centuries previously, silk performed a similar function for the famous Chinese pilgrim Xuanzang. When he stopped in the Central Asian state of Gaochang, the king there, who was a devout Buddhist patron, presented his guest with so many silks and other gifts that the pilgrim needed 30 horses and 24 laborers to carry it all away. The king also wrote 24 letters of introduction to the various kings whose land Xuanzang would need to pass through on his onward journey. Each letter was attached to a bolt of damask and, to the most powerful and possibly most fearsome king, Yagbu Khan of the Western Turks, an additional incentive of 500 bolts of damask and painted silk and 2 cartloads of fruit were sent. The rich stew of ideas and cultures facilitated by the Silk Roads left their mark even in the designs of the silks being produced and traded. Animals not native to or revered in China, lions, elephants, peacocks, winged horses, and even camels began to creep into the motifs of embroidered silks. Helios, the Grecian sun god, gained ascendancy in Central Asia after the conquests of Alexander the Great from around 334 BC, and depictions of him began to appear too. Similarly, Buddhist symbols were adopted as the religion itself began to gain a foothold in China, and as China's trade with the Sassanid Empire, which ruled much of Central Asia from AD 224 to 651, increased, they began adapting their sophisticated, colourful, woven jinn fabrics to suit Sasanian tastes. Persian jinn fabrics were common enough after around AD 455 to be given their own name, Bosijin. This term appears again and again in Chinese literature as a particular favourite of elites. Despite, or more likely because of the popularity of these foreign weaves in China, there were repeated attempts to push back against the interlopers. In the year AD 771, for example, Emperor Daizong banned their production in China. Half a century later, presumably after the measure failed miserably, Emperor Wenzong renewed it, this time trying to ensure compliance by ordering the special looms required to make the particularly fashionable Liaoling twill damasks to be burned. By this time, of course, it was far too late. Foreign influences were too deeply embedded into the production of Chinese silks to be picked out. The truth of this can be seen from a single silk fragment from the Eastern Han era, AD 25 to 220. At the centre of the design sits Helios, the Greek god of the sun, cross-legged in a recognisably Indian style on a Buddhist lotus throne. The pearl roundel in which Helios is enthroned, indeed the entire composition, shows Sasanian influence, and yet there are also homegrown elements, such as dragon-headed banners. The weave, too, is recognizably Chinese. No matter where silk went, or the weaves or designs used to decorate it, it was always a potent status symbol, a valuable trading good, and a potential source of income for any country that could produce it. An account of the Black Tartars, written in 1237, notes that the Mongols' robes fasten on the right and have square collars. They were originally made of felt and sheepskin, but now they are made of satin with gold threads. Kublai Khan, 1215 to 94, the Mongol ruler who also founded the Yuan dynasty in China after his conquest in 1271, was apparently especially enamored of silk. One writer, who no doubt heavily embroidered his tail for effect, wrote that the Khan's banquets were attended by 40,000 people, and that those waiting on the guests had their noses and mouths swathed in fine napkins of silk and gold, so that the food and drink are not contaminated by their breath or effluence. Further afield, lust and longing for silk was just as pronounced. Crusaders of the Knights of St. John of Jerusalem, an order active from 1099, were traditionally given a silk cloak after a tour of duty. King John of England, who died just 1 year after the Kublai Khan's birth, but a world away, shared the Mongol ruler's legendary appetite for silk. An inventory taken in 1216 of Corfe Castle in Dorset, his favourite residence, found no fewer than 185 silk shirts. James I, 1566 to 1625, who ruled England centuries later, was similarly afflicted. So much so, in fact, that he made a concerted but ill-fated attempt to establish the production of silk in his kingdom. He offered 10,000 subsidized mulberry trees to his subjects so that the insects would have sufficient food, and employed a couple at an estate southeast of London to make Greenwich silk for an annual stipend of £60. He also appointed a special governor of the chamber, whose duties included carrying a couple of the wriggling insects whithersoever His Majesty went. Consignments of silkworms and mulberry saplings were sent by His Majesty to the settlement named after him in the New World, Jamestown, Virginia, in the hopes of establishing a silk industry in Britain's colonies. The experiments continued for some years with little success. A miserable 113 kilograms of silk was all that was reaped from Virginia between 1731 and 1755. And although some English silk was made, Queen Anne of Denmark wore an English silk taffeta gown on James I's birthday 1 year, the experiment was eventually quietly abandoned. Silk also made its way to early medieval Scandinavia. Chinese silks have been found in graves in Sweden, Denmark, Finland, and Norway. Fabrics from Byzantium and Persia have also been found in Viking graves. Perhaps the most prestigious silks found in Scandinavia, however, were in the Oseberg ship. Buried as part of a grave mound for two women in AD 834, when it was unearthed in 1904 in Vestfold, Norway, this vessel was found to contain over 100 scraps of silken fabric. The majority were samite, a rich fabric interwoven with gold and silver that had been cut into narrow strips and sewn onto garment hems as decoration. A dozen pieces of embroidery, likely made with imported thread, were also found, along with some locally produced textiles woven with both wool and silk. Most were woven using a sophisticated technique that requires a special loom native to Central Asia. On at least one of the pieces was a motif known as the Shanok, literally king bird, a hawk-like creature gripping a pearl tiara in its beak, that in Persian mythology represents royal blessing. Other symbols include deadly-looking cloverleaf axes and a Zoroastrian symbol taken from the zodiac. The Oseberg find was the oldest known cache of Viking-age silk in Norway, and it was initially assumed that the silk had been looted from Britain or Ireland on a raid. Since then, however, more silk of a similar age has been found, making it more likely that silk was being traded directly into Scandinavia. Immodest apparel. Everywhere these frail-limbed and mincing effeminates, flowing of locks, bedecked with an infinite number of garments of silk whose names ever change, the wanters and lechers to snare, are eagerly welcomed. Petronius, Satyricon, 1st century AD. During the late 1st century AD, Roman society became infamous for its excess. It was during this period that Petronius, a courtier to the Emperor Nero, wrote Satyricon, an angry satire that had at its heart the nadir of vulgar, ostentatious dinner parties. Trimalchio, an extravagantly nouveau riche former slave, tries in vain to impress his high-born guests with one showy excess after another. His servants sing instead of speaking. They serve honeyed dormice sprinkled with poppy seeds, dishes that represent each sign of the zodiac, and a roast pig stuffed with live birds. Guests' hands are washed with wine, an accidentally dropped silver dish is casually thrown away, and Trimalchio finally directs his entire household to act out a dry run of his funeral. The entire household is dressed in extravagant silks. At the time Satyricon was written, wealth was flowing into Rome from foreign conquests, most notably Egypt, after the defeat of Cleopatra at the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. Interest rates fell from 12% to 4%, meaning that suddenly even ordinary citizens were able to indulge their tastes for exotic goods. Although full of bawdy wit, Satyricon is near-anthropological in its skewering of the over-the-top fashions Roman citizens were suddenly obsessed with. One particular affectation, to the author's eye, was silk. It came to the empire along the Silk Roads in exchange for grain from Egypt, gold from Spain, topaz from the Red Sea, coral, glass, wine, and wool. We do not know when precisely it arrived. Dio Cassius claims that Romans first saw high-quality silk at the Battle of Carrhae in 53 BC, when the Parthians unfurled their snapping banners. If this is true, then it wasn't the most felicitous introduction, as the Romans were promptly defeated. To the Roman mind, China was firmly associated with this one product. The Latin name for China is Serica. Silk is sericum. Since they were so far away, however, and were likely hearing about sericulture through a very long-distance version of Chinese whispers, it isn't surprising that their understanding of silk production was initially rather eccentric. Pliny mentions a woolen substance obtained from the trees in Chinese forests in one section of his Natural History, but in the chapter on insects, he seems better informed. Silkworms, he writes here, weave webs similar to those of the spider, the material of which is used for making the more costly and luxurious garment of females. Nor was it just ordinary citizens putting silk to use. Decorative textiles were employed to add drama and colour to public buildings. When Julius Caesar paid for silk awnings to be hung throughout Rome to provide shade for all the spectators at his military triumph, it was seen as a clear statement of not just his wealth, but his intention to seize power. Emperor Nero is said to have hung star-spangled blue awnings over amphitheatres and commissioned a textile, likely also made from silk, that was dyed purple and decorated with an image of him standing in a chariot, the Roman equivalent of commissioning a portrait of yourself driving a sports car. Murals at Herculaneum and Pompeii, most famously those in the blood-red room at the Villa of Mysteries, show elite women wearing translucent fabrics that look very much like fine, loosely woven silk. The fabric even reached Roman Britain. Near Hadrian's Wall, there is an inscription commemorating a merchant from Palmyra who apparently supplied silk banners to the legions stationed nearby. Despite this reach, it retained its glamour, which, coupled with exorbitant prices, gave ostentatious Romans of the sort that Petronius skewers so precisely in Satyricon ample opportunity for showing off. Martial, the satirical poet, offered the gift of a gold hairpin with one of his verses. "Insert a pin to hold up your twisted hair so that your moistened locks may not damage your bright silks." There was, naturally enough, a backlash. Contemporaries bemoaned the huge sums being spent on this foreign fabric. According to Pliny the Elder, each year emperors spend about 100 million sesterces, 100,000 ounces of gold, buying silks from the East. This was a huge amount, roughly equivalent to 10% of the annual budget, and it wasn't just the emperors he complained, but ordinary people, and, this last with particular venom, vain women. All this money was being spent purely to enable the Roman lady to shimmer in public. Such vast sums would be far better spent, according to him, on worthier and preferably Roman goods. Pliny, of course, ignored the fact that trade was flowing both ways. Silk was also regarded as decadent. The poet Horace, who died in 8 BC when silk was still probably relatively novel, described prostitutes as early adopters. "Through the Cohen silk, it is as easy for you to see as if she were naked, whether she has an unshapely leg, whether her foot is ugly. Her waist you can examine with your eyes." If this was the case, then perhaps it goes some way to explaining the fuss made by more conservative commentators when silks were taken up by other Roman women. "I see silk clothing," Seneca fumed, "but how can this be called clothing when it offers nothing that could possibly afford protection to the body or provide any modesty? Silk is imported so that our married women can show as much of their bodies to people in the street as they display to their lovers in the bedroom." Women wearing silks was bad enough, but the deepest opprobrium was reserved for men who did the same. A decree was passed, Ne vestis serica viros foedaret, that forbade men from wearing silk. This was one of a raft of measures against unmanly conspicuous consumption. The use of gold plate for private banquets, for example, was also prohibited. Scorn is heaped upon the fictional Trimalchio, for his love of silk dyed a deep purple at Tyre with mollusks, the priciest fabric of the ancient world. According to Suetonius, admittedly a scurrilous gossip, Emperor Caligula, AD 12 to 41, liked to appear in public in bracelets, silken tunics, embroidered cloaks encrusted with jewels, and at times in the low shoes which are used by females. Conservative Romans were worried that such luxurious garb would blunt the martial spirit that had won them their empire and wealth in the first place, an echo of the hope that the Chinese harboured that their silks would blunt the threat posed by the Xiongnu forces. Such fears roil through a passage from Pliny. "Now even men will wear silk clothing in the summer because of its lightness, and they do not feel ashamed. Once we used to wear leather cuirasses, but our fashions have become so bizarre that even a toga is now considered to be unnecessarily heavy. Yet we have left Assyrian silk dresses to the women, thus far." The Romans were not the only ones who saw seeds of destruction in the luxuries that ran through the Silk Roads. In 1900, when Oral Stein began searching the Gobi Desert for the lost city of Dandanwalik, a local warned him against the endeavour. "The city was still there," the man told Stein, "and it was indeed filled with treasure. Gold and silver lay thick among the sand-smoothed stones. The problem was the spell that had been cast over it all. Over the centuries, many had travelled there with caravans hoping to carry away fortunes. One by one, they loaded up as much as they could, so that their mules and camels groaned under the strain. But as each set off, they found they were unable to leave. Every attempt to strike out into the desert led the caravans back to the dead orchards and tumbled walls of Dandanwilik, until at last men and beast collapsed in exhaustion. The only way to escape the curse, according to this tale, was to unload every gem and ingot, leaving the city as empty-handed as they had arrived.